This episode of the Folklore Podcast Book Club is an audio version of an episode originally made for YouTube. To see the original, with any pictorial references, please visit www.youtube.com/folklorepodcast and click on the Book Club playlist.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Folklore Podcast Book Club. Today we're going to be looking at the book New Queer Horror Film and Television, part of the Horror Studies series from the University of Wales Press, edited by Darren Elliott Smith and John Edgar Browning. And this is an anthology book comprising essays that study the form, aesthetics and representations of LGBTQ plus identities in the new queer horror subgenre. Joining me to discuss this book is my guest reviewer for this episode, Howard David Ingham from Room 207 Press, also my co-creator of the Rural Gothic live events that we run. And they've been looking at this book from a queer perspective in order to give a true and proper insight, in my opinion, into the material that's contained herein. Here's what Howard thought of the book in my discussion with them. So joining me on this episode of the Folklore Podcast Book Club is my colleague and friend from Room 207 Press, Howard David Ingham. Howard, welcome.
Hi, Mark.
Nice to see you again. Outside of our normal rural gothic context.
Yes, indeed.
But why not?
And we're filming this one day before our fifth rural gothic.
Yeah, I think it is. Yes, rural gothic queer horror, which is quite timely considering the book that we're about to look at. And that is from the University of Wales Press, and that is this book, New Queer Horror, Film and television from their horror studies series. Now, I gave a copy of this to Howard, and they have very kindly read through this book as well for me, because they are, after all, something of an expert. You may wish to disagree, I know, but tough luck in this subject. Howard is the author of What Have You Written, Howard? Go on.
I've written We Don't Go Back, A Watcher's Guide to Folk Horror, The Age of Miracles, a collection of essays about fake news generally. And I've got a book coming out in the next few weeks, which is called Cult Cinema, which is about brainwashing, bad religion and sects in film and television, with kind of a focus on exploitation and horror, but it goes to other places too. Is sort of a book which I think is probably the only book that gives Martyrs and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt the same weight, which is something I'm quite proud of. But
excellent.
We'll see how it goes.
I'm looking forward to that one. So they are an expert in this area, despite what they might tell you otherwise, which is why I have asked them to look at this book. Now, this is split into three sections, isn't it? But before we go into those, let's just look at the book as a broad overview. This is a collection of academic essays, is that fair to say?
It is. It's an academic book. I mean, what you've got there in your hand is a fairly compact paperback.
Yeah,
you know, it's you know, what's a couple hundred pages, isn't it? And for 230 something pages.
Yes.
And
yeah,
in that paperback goes for the frankly academic price range of about £45. So it's fair to say it's not for the casual reader. Okay, it's not for a casual reader. You are going to be academic invested in this book. You want this book because it is going to help you, right? If you're doing media studies or gothic stuff, this might be a book that's worth having. If you are in the middle of a PhD in media studies, in Gothic fiction, that sort of thing, this is a book that is worth having. If you're an undergraduate, it's probably a useful book to have. It's the sort of book that I'd like to have, but I can't justify paying £45 for a hard copy, because simply I don't have 45 quid to spend on a book of academic papers. And specifically, it being a book of academic papers, these academic papers are very, very laser focused on certain things, because once you get to a certain level of academia, you become laser focused on certain points. You begin to go straight down very narrow avenues. So what you get is a collection of essays, and if you are interested in writing and stuff, in learning about this stuff, as you know I am, you know, I write about this stuff regularly, you may find that there are only a few essays in the book that are of direct interest to you, and they give you some sort of idea. There are actually two papers. This got two whole chapters. I think there are two chapters. Yeah, there are two chapters that focus on a 2012 movie called Jack and Diane, which is not a particularly, you know, it's not a very well-known movie. In fact, I hadn't heard of it. And it's a teenage werewolf romance, artsy teenage werewolf romance that was uniformly panned by critics, as far as I can make out, but which is obviously an interesting movie, because a lot of bad movies or critically panned movies are very interesting. And yeah, so I actually kind of want to see it now, but at the same time, you know, I read the, you know, I skimmed those chapters because I've not seen Jack and Diane, so I don't actually know if their take on Jack and Diane is that great, really. It might be. I'm fairly certain that they're probably very solid takes on Jack and Diane. Both of them compare this movie, Jack and Diane, with other movies, and one of them compares Jack and Diane with Black Swan, which is a film that I have seen and which I do have thoughts about, and which I'm probably going to have to watch again soon. But yeah, so, you know, so to give you an idea of what they look at, you've got Rob Zombie's The Lord of Salem. You've got a couple of things generally about werewolf movies, which are probably like the most widely applicable essays. You've got a great essay on American Horror Story Coven. You've got Final Destination, Let the Right One In, Hannibal. The remake of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Did you know there was a remake of the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Oh, yes. I knew there was a remake of the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah,
again, universally panned by pretty much everybody in the world.
Universally panned. Mm. And to be fair, this one actually gives quite good reasons, I think, as to why it was universally panned. You know, it basically... there are words that on the internet get used a lot and people don't actually understand what they mean, and one of those words is problematic. But this is an essay that uses the word problematic correctly in a focused fashion and explains exactly what it means. So yeah, I mean, Jeepers Creepers, another one. You know, did you realize that the creeper from Jeepers Creepers was a queer icon?
No, I did not. And that's interesting. I mean, that really is, you know, already at its very base level of being a book about queer horror, it's teaching lessons right from the word go as to how some of these characters are viewed. Now, I mean, let's have a look at the kind of broad description. So looking at the back of the book, these are edited by two academics, Darren Elliott Smith, who's a senior lecturer in film and gender at the University of Stirling,
and John Edgar Browning, who's professor of liberal arts in Georgia, in the USA.
Well, liberal arts in America is basically just like humanities.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's quite a broad overview.
So it's not liberal arts.
Not liberal in that sense.
As opposed to conservative arts.
Yeah.
It's, it's professional.
Yes, the humanities. Yeah. So they describe it on the back of the book. This anthology comprises essays that study the form, aesthetics, and representations of LGBTQ plus identities in an emerging subgenre of film and television termed new queer horror. What do we mean by new queer horror in the terms of how this book presents it?
Well, I think this film... this understands new queer horror. It's pretty much everything in the book is pretty recent. I mean, as far as I can make out, aside from the Rocky Horror essay, which is generally about the remake, but which nonetheless spends a lot of time critiquing the original because it's got to critique the original in order to give you a context for the remake.
Yeah.
So if you don't count that, then the oldest things that they look at are really sort of things around Black Swan, Let the Right One In, 2010, right? And I mean, you got to bear in mind the academic works have kind of a lead in, particularly in humanities, and so I mean the. You know, all the stuff's referenced, but the focus is generally on anything from the second decade of the 21st century on the whole, really. So it's new as in it's, you know,
they are newly made
lives of people who are under the age of 30.
Yeah, newly made material.
Yeah, newish. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it breaks this down into three parts, of which there are four essays in each part, and I'm not suggesting that we're going to go through each of these essays in turn, because that's not what we're looking to do necessarily. But looking at the themes of each part that's broken down, so the first section of this book looks at transforming, rereading, and remaking queer horror. Now, you've already touched upon the fact that Jeepers Creepers is a rereading of the subject material in some respects in a queer aspect. Rocky Horror is a remaking, and then Let the Right One In and Let Me In is the queer vampire in a more obvious sense. And then the fourth one is about Hannibal, which I wonder how many people are thinking queer horror as a piece of material when they think of Hannibal, for example. Are there very many surprises in this section?
Well, it depends on what you think of as a surprise, really. I mean, there's lots of stuff I didn't know. You know, there's lots of stuff. I've not actually ever watched Hannibal, you know, so I kind of, you know, look at it. This is actually, I actually felt quite unknowledgeable. I mean, you say I'm an expert, right? But there's a lot of stuff I haven't watched in this book that's talked about. So my expertise avails me nothing.
But you are used to working with the themes and that.
I'm used to working with the themes. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's so, you know, you look at Hannibal. I mean, I actually it's interesting. I'm completely down with the wide net they cast. I mean, I said that, you know, this in two whole chapters about Jack and Diane, but that's because Jack and Diane is a lesbian werewolf romance, right? It's like explicitly queer. And actually, that's one thing that I do want to say about this that's important, in that the reason that this book matters is because most work on queer horror, according to the editor of the book, and I think this is fair, has been about implicit queer themes and subtext and that sort of thing, right? And this book is about obvious gayness and queerness in horror, right? So it makes sense that Jack and Diane, the lesbian werewolf romance, would have Pride of Place here because it's gay. It's a gay movie, and that's important to note. They want to talk about explicitly queer horror rather than queerness in horror, because you look, or to put it another way, and this is something that was picked up a while back, is that close reading is a queer thing. Okay. And this is not my thought. This is a thought that someone else had a while back. I can't remember who it was, but close reading is a queer enterprise because we spend our entire lives looking for things because it's not there front and center like it is for all you straights. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time doing close reading, right? So, you know, queer readings of things are invariably close readings. You know, and there's a lot of close readings of these things, but it's quite nice. I think the point is that they're looking at these things in a way, they're looking at things that don't require such close readings in order to pull out the queer stuff. Meaning that they're actually a lot of research into queer horror as generally goes along the lines of, this film is actually queer. Here is why. Right? Mm-hmm. So, and therefore the arguments and the research are like basically there in order to demonstrate that this is actually queer and then pull something out of that. What this book is about taking stuff that is obviously queer, where you don't actually have to go through those first 3, 4, 5 stages of proving its queerness. Like, or, you know, taking from science fiction thing, The Matrix is a film about is a film about the trans experience, and apparently the Wachowski sisters have come out and basically said that. And those of us spent ages, those of us who wrote big long essays about The Matrix, basically just went, okay, and you basically just spent all these stages going, it's because it's queer because of this, because of this, because of this, because, and that's here. You've got, oh, here's a queer film. Let's talk about what it says about people. Let's talk about what it says about us. Let's talk about what it brings out in the world. Does that, do you see what I mean?
Yeah, basically.
Because you can skip the having to prove that it's queer in the first place part and actually do a close reading that doesn't depend on that.
Yes. Yeah.
You can do stuff. So and it's interesting, you know, and I mean, you get things like the essay about Let the Right One In is particularly interesting, because that actually comes out, because obviously that's a book and 2 movie adaptations, and it does all of them. It goes through all of them and explains the differences between the 3 of them, the original novel, the Swedish movie with the screenplay by the novel's author, and the American remake directed by Matt Reeves. And it actually says that the queer subtext, the queer text, is actually better in the Swedish movie rather than the novel, because the novel does a lot of stuff that maybe 10 years later we would not do. And the novel also is, it's weird, the novel is explicit in a way that actually locks out a whole lot of interpretations and things, which is weird. Which again, you know, I found that particularly, I think that was basically of the stuff I read in the book, probably the thing that most struck me is a really good piece, really. It's the one I most enjoyed. I think.
So the second section looks at adolescent horror. Does that mean that it approaches it in a different way?
Or are
the readings similar, but they're just dealing with an audience demographic that's different, for example?
You've got to bear in mind that there is a much larger section of queer literature that is coming of age stories than there is perhaps in straight literature. Right, there's plenty of straight coming of age stories, and straight cinema. There's plenty of straight coming of age stories, but there's lots of other things as well. But you can almost argue that pretty much the majority is either directly or metaphorically a coming of age story in queer stuff. Many queer narratives are about self-discovery, so it makes sense that the three sections you have are one about remaking and rereading queer horror. So one is about basically there's a queer horror text. This is what happens when we do it again. Okay, that's fundamentally it. So the Jeepers Creepers essay is largely about how the creeper is kind of like Buffalo Bill and Silence of the Lambs, and it's about how referential it is. The Rocky Horror one is about the Rocky Horror remake and why it's not great. And the Let the Right One In one is about what happens when you adapt and readapt something. The Hannibal, how many versions of Hannibal have there been? There's been at least three versions of Hannibal Lecter on film and TV. So like the recent TV series Hannibal, the most recent one is therefore a remake of a remake of an adaptation, so that's that, because we do like to, horror is often all about retreading stuff. And I mean, generally media in the last decade is about retreading stuff. I was, one of the other things I do when I'm not writing about horror is that I've been writing about the Planet of the Apes series, right? And obviously there were three Planet of the Apes movies that came out in the last decade.
Yeah.
And in the last decade, I went and checked to see, how many franchises had been resurrected either successfully or falsely, or successfully or unsuccessfully in the 2010s, right? So there was a failed attempt at a King Arthur franchise. There was a Universal Monsters franchise that fizzled after two movies. Jurassic Park came back for another two movies. The Terminator came back for another two movies. There was two more Aliens movies. Rocky and Rambo and Mad Max had fourth parts to each of their trilogies. Actually, I think it was Rocky 5, Rocky 6. Mm. In fact, there were two more Rocky movies, weren't there, really?
And we can look forward to another Indiana Jones as well, just about.
Yeah, another Indiana Jones movie is coming out. And it's just, basically cinema in the last 10 years is about retreads, largely. New things have been on. You look at the... I was looking at the top 10 most successful movies of 2014, because that's the only time the Planet of the Apes movie has made the top 10. And the only one that wasn't a superhero movie or a franchise movie that was a superhero movie was one of Christopher Nolan's insufferable Look at Me, I'm an Important Movie pieces. Right. So, like... I could probably tell you which one it was, but they all mushed together in some sort of like terrible, tasteful kind of like blur. Anyway, so having an entire section about rereading and remaking queer horror is important, because essentially, everything gets remade at the moment. Things get remade over and over and over again, and that's important. But then you have an entire section about adolescence, and that's important as well, because a vast number of queer narratives, or coming of age narratives, the narratives of discovery, of finding yourself. So things like Jack and Diane, that's going to be there. You're going to have Final Destination, which is all about teenagers, and they talk about the queerness in Final Destination. And there's an essay about Adventure Time. And Marceline, the Vampire Queen, in Adventure Time. And I don't know if you've ever sat down and watched Adventure Time with your kids.
I have not, no.
It's often really disturbing. Like, it's often really quite bothersome. Mm. And then the third one is largely about werewolves and witches.
Yes. The third section is more of, I suppose, if approaching this in terms of a podcast that predominantly looks at folklore and its crossover with other areas.
Yeah, I mean, this is more in your yard.
I mean, really. all of this is irrelevant, absolutely. But yes, we're looking at some obvious tropes, aren't we, in the third part that you would expect to see in kind of horror genre. So I mean, the part three, badass witches and queer wolves, yeah, kind of sums it up, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes, and I think, but and I mean, obviously, witches and werewolves are both they're both very much about. Okay, you see, people seem to think that the quintessentially gay horror horror antagonist is the vampire.
Mm.
Right, people think it is, and that's Anne Rice's fault, very much so, with a little bit of Poppy Zebright's fault as well. But actually, often the queer vampire is something that is something that's come up with by straight people. And actually, werewolves and witches are more gay. So one might have expected an entire set of chapters about gay vampires. Like, we're going to have two separate talks about lesbian vampires in the next two Rural Gothic events, in fact.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
But actually, werewolves have a sense of community in a way that, you know, is it witches who have covens? And I think there's the metaphor of gay people finding their community, finding their tribe, finding their groups. You have often people who are queer will find it difficult to bond within their own families and therefore make families. And werewolf packs and vampire witch covens are there. So you have and I mean, you know, if you're going to talk about witch covens and talk about gayness, you're going to talk about American Horror Story Coven, of which there is a thing, and you know, you have American Horror Story Coven has, of course, the Myrtle Snow, the amazing the one of the greatest characters in horror television. You know, a witch who, while she's being burned at the stake, decides to yell as her final word, Balenciaga. You have, and of course, Ryan Murphy, everything Ryan Murphy does is very, very camp. There is a high level of gayness in it. The only disappointing thing with the American Horror Story essay is that American Horror Story Coven essay, it doesn't mention American Horror Story Apocalypse beyond a couple of sentences at the end, really.
Hmm.
Which I don't know if you're familiar with American Story Horror Story.
I haven't got that far through it.
It's
my watch list. I am partway through watching from the beginning. But
American Horror Story Apocalypse is the one season so far that you absolutely cannot see without having seen the others.
Right.
Right. It makes reference to Hotel and it makes reference to Roanoke, but it is a direct sequel of both Murder House and Coven. And that's that's not as much of a spoiler as it sounds like, right? But yeah, but it's a direct sequel of those two, and you have to have seen them. And you get a coven of gay male witches in it as well. This is a spoiler. Played by, one of them's Billy Porter, who you can imagine is fabulous. He's absolutely on point. It's just really just the camp is high in this one. More camp than Butlins. But you know, it's just, yeah. But I have a feeling that the reason that the 2018 American Horror Story series only gets a line at the end is because of the lead-in with stuff like this. So I would imagine, looking at this, that none of these essays was really drafted. You know, they probably got the chance to like edit them later on. I imagine none of them predated 2018, to be honest. Post-dated 2018, you know, they're all a few years old now, yeah. Because that's how academic literature works. In terms of style, you got to be familiar with academic literature to get something out of this.
Yes, I was going to say, and with speaking, I mean, we accept that this is an academic book and is less likely to be of general interest than some of the other books that we've discussed on here, but the content certainly is, but the style not necessarily so. How accessible is it to a non-academic audience?
That's a good question. I think that, well, I think if you're not an academic audience, you're actually going to have to, at the very least, have seen the things that they're talking about.
Yeah.
Right. Which seems like a ridiculously silly thing to say, but I think it's an important point. These things are actually academic. You probably are. You don't need to really be intimately familiar with the literature, but you probably need to know. Like, it probably helps if you know who Mikhail Bakhtin is and stuff like that. Who, incidentally, is very important in cultural theory and stuff. So, you know, I mean, that sounds really kind of like rarefied and highfalutin, but Mikhail Bakhtin is one of those ones that's like, once you're at first year undergraduate level and you're doing media studies, you know who Mikhail Bakhtin is. Okay, right. He invented the term of the carnivalesque.
Yes.
Okay. So you need to have, in order to get, I think, anything out of it at all, you need to have a grounding in first principles of cultural and media studies. You don't need to be a consulting professor of media studies to get this. You don't need to be channeling Marshall McLuhan's spirit in a seance on a regular basis, right, to be able to make head or tail out of it. But you probably need to be... You need to have gotten past Media Studies 101.
For this to be of any use at all. I think that's a fair comment, because that's the kind of the level that the book is aimed at, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah. You've got to be able to understand it. You've got to be able to understand things like academic sentence constructions and stuff like that. This is a thing, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely a fair comment. But so bearing all of that in mind, then, just to close this off completely, New Queer Horror Film and Television, University of Wales Press.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did. I did. I enjoyed it because I've actually gone through a phase of not reading anything particularly challenging for a while. And it's quite nice to read something challenging sometimes. It's quite nice to actually sort of, you know, flex the brain muscles or whatever. I quite enjoyed it because I learned about stuff. I learned that Jack and Diane exists and now I want to watch that movie, which I think any book that mentions films that you haven't seen and makes you want to watch them is probably, that's fundamentally my baseline level. You know, if it actually makes you go, oh, yeah. That does sound interesting. Then, you know, I want to see Jack and Diane. I probably will see Jack and Diane.
Then that essay, at least, has certainly done its job, because as somebody who works with film and television all the time in your writing, then to encourage you to want to see something is obviously putting the subject matter across in a good way, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. And I think it's... There's a terrible stereotype of academic writers that essentially they kill all the passion in things. This is false, right? Most people, when they're at this level of academia, are obsessed, okay, with what they're writing about. No one in this book is writing something that they're not absolutely obsessed with to a somewhat disturbing level, probably, right? And the question is not whether they make it sound dry and boring. The question is whether their obsession drives you off, which is a different question. But also whether their obsession perhaps comes through in very precise technical language. Because there's an art to writing academic literature. There is an art to it and a craft, which is quite different from the sort of thing I write. Because I write frothy pieces where I just explain stuff in words that I understand.
You write for a wider audience at the end of the day.
I write for about three people. But you know what I mean. So these things, but essentially, this is a book of things that are written for a purpose. This is a book of essays that are written to be useful, fundamentally. And their utility is pretty paramount here. If you are doing undergraduate level study in media studies and you're looking at horror, you're doing the course on Gothic, which most media studies and English departments do these days, you would be well served getting hold of this if you are really interested in the semiotics of queerness. This is a useful thing to have. If you are doing research, it's an important part of the conversation around these things. And that's really where we're going to be. If you're a casual reader who just wants to sit down with something on the toilet and go, oh yeah, I want to know about this movie, you're probably not going to have much luck, but then it's not for you anyway.
Yes, absolutely. That's not the demographic that it's aimed at, is it? So at the end of the day, it's a nicely presented book. It's well edited. It's nicely put together. The subject matter is, as you say, written by people who have a level of detail that you won't find from a lot of authors. And if you sit within that audience demographic, then it absolutely goes on to the recommended list.
Yeah. Basically, if you need a book that's going to be useful, and deep dives into queer horror are a thing that will be useful for you, this book is intended to be useful, and I think it is.
Brilliant, absolutely. So there we go. New queer horror film and television, University of Wales Press, available as a paperback or as an ebook from their website. Do keep an eye on the Twitter feed for University of Wales Press, because they're often putting out discounts on a lot of their books to tie in with different events.
Such as?
They're doing one this weekend for us for our queer horror event with 20% discount on a number of books from the University of Wales Press range. And they do this a lot with different events as they come and go, so well worth following their Twitter feed for that. Howard, thank you so much for joining me today on the book club. It's a fascinating,
it's always a pleasure,
discussion. Thank you. I should look forward to seeing you again very soon.
Indeed.
Thanks to Howard for giving their insights into this book. You'll find details on the Folklore Podcast website of how to get hold of a copy if you'd like to read this title for yourself. If you enjoy material put out by the Folklore Podcast, both in the book club and on the main feed and anywhere else that we work, and you'd like to support what we do, then please consider joining our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast, or alternatively visit our website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com, where you can hit the donate button on the landing page to make a small donation. Any contribution, great or small, is appreciated, as it helps us to keep producing this material. And of course, you can always just share our work with friends and others if you want to support us in that way too. Thank you so much for joining us, and see you next time.